Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich. Legal Face Off is about to begin.
Welcome to Legal Face Off. I'm Craig Collins sitting in for Sam Panjanovich. Rich Lenkov is here. Tina Martini is in studio. And we are going to kick things off the right way by immediately talking to one of the AG candidates, one of the more interesting candidates, I'd say, Governor Quinn. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you, all you guys, for giving me an opportunity to talk about running for Attorney General. I think it's a very important office. It's a lawyer for the people of Illinois, and I think when you talk about people, you're talking about consumers and taxpayers and veterans and workers and people who are voters. Attorney General's got to represent all of them, and I've tried to do that through my whole life, and I helped set up the Citizen Utility Board, which is Illinois' largest consumer group, and as Attorney General, I intend to work with CUB to make sure consumers are treated fairly by the big utilities, ComEd and People's Gas and Nicor and AT&T. It's important to have an Attorney General take some on when they're out of line.
Governor, let's talk about violence and gun safety. That's obviously very much in the news in the wake of Parkland and the seemingly endless examples of violence involving guns in our society. What role do you see for the Attorney General should you be elected, and how do you how would you work with both local law enforcement and on the federal level to curb the scourge of gun violence?
Well, I think it's a very important issue. When I was governor, I signed bills to deal with lost and stolen guns and also to deal with issues of health that make sure that we have mental health treatment for everyone. But right now what we need in Illinois is licensing gun dealers. And I was very disappointed today when Rauner vetoed a very important public safety measure that would have licensed gun dealers in our state. I totally disagree with his veto. I think we also need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines. These are the weapons that have been used to kill people in Parkland, Florida, and many other places across America, including Newtown, Connecticut. The parents of those first and second graders who were killed in Connecticut, they came to Illinois. I had them stay at the governor's mansion, and we worked on banning assault weapons and these high-capacity ammunition magazines, and we actually put a referendum on the ballot for the voters of Cook County to vote against those weapons and to have a law that would ban them completely. And I really feel as Attorney General, you've got to lead the charge to get strong laws passed to ban these weapons, especially in the hands of criminals and those with mental illness, and also to make sure that we protect everyday people as they go to school or go to a theater or go to anywhere else in life. They shouldn't be subject to attack by military weapons by someone who's out to kill them.
Governor, what about sexual harassment and sexual assault? Obviously, another topic that is very much in the news. Later on in the show, we'll have Gloria Allred on talking about her fight on behalf of women on these issues for over 40 years. Where do you stand specifically on the statute of limitations for victims of both sexual harassment and sexual assault?
Well, I think the statute of limitations for both harms have to be lifted. Really, I don't think there should be a statute of limitations on sexual harassment claims or sexual assault. You know, in the Illinois General Assembly, for 3 years, they did not have a legislative inspector general that anyone who was harmed by sexual harassment could even bring their claim to. And I'm running against Senator Raul, and we've been on these debates and forums, and there's no good explanation why the members of the General Assembly, especially the Senate, where there was a claim against the senator for sexual harassment, and it was thrown in a binder, wasn't investigated. And I think the Attorney General's got to be there on behalf of any victim who has a claim to make sure that justice is done. This is not right that anyone in Illinois should be bullied or harassed. I think whether it's the workplace, in private practice, private life, or down in Springfield or any other government place, there's absolutely no place to have those who are harmed without a place to go to get justice.
So, Governor, why don't you talk to us a bit about your position on fighting for consumers and unfair corporate practices?
Yeah, well, I think this is a key role for the Illinois Attorney General. It's pretty hard for one person to take on ComEd or a big insurance company or a big bank when they're out of line and unfair. That's why we started, as I said earlier, the Citizen Utility Board that bands together consumers. Over 100,000 people belong to an organization, CUP, Citizen Utility Board, that I got started way back when. And I think the Attorney General's got to work with utility consumers to make sure that these big companies don't harm people who live from paycheck to paycheck. But that also goes for health insurance. You know, I signed the bill to extend the Affordable Care Act to the people of Illinois. Over a million people care coverage because of that, and we can't let Trump or his allies down off in Washington take away health care for the people of Illinois. And so the Attorney General's got to go to court, protect the law, protect people decent health insurance, and that goes whether it's taking on the big health insurance issue or big banks when they were out of line with unfair mortgages that caused a lot of people to go into foreclosure. I worked with Attorney General Lisa Madigan on that issue when I was governor. We got to keep on working on it. We can't let banks with their unfair fees and their practices with respect to mortgages take people's homes away. So I really feel the Attorney General's got to be the number one consumer advocate in this state on behalf of everybody, including red light camera operators. Right now, they're taking advantage of people with these unfair tickets, a $100 ticket. They say, well, you didn't stop long enough at right turn on red. That's a lot of baloney, and we got to take them to court and take them on to make sure these red light camera operators are brought to justice as well.
Governor, your critics, among them Kwame Raoul, who you mentioned earlier, who is running against you for the AG in this Democratic race for AG, have criticized your stance on gun violence, talking about how, as governor, you were unsuccessful in pushing for a ban on assault weapons, the sale of high capacity ammunition magazines. You tried to rewrite the concealed carry legislation to put in tougher restrictions. So if you were unable to do so as governor, what makes you think that you would be able to do so in the Attorney General role?
Well, number one, for the listeners, the facts are that I did put in a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines. My opponent, Senator Kwame Raoul, voted to override action and put in law a situation where there would not be a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines. I'm for doing that. He didn't help at all when I was governor. I think that's why I put a referendum on the ballot in Cook County, letting the senator know and many others that the people are for what I was trying to do. If you're Attorney General, you've got to keep on fighting. You never give up. And I think right now is a moment in history in America, not only in Illinois, but in America, where we can take on the NRA. And I have. I've been targeted by the NRA, not only in this race for Attorney General, but when I was governor, because they didn't like the fact that I was a strong gun safety person. And I want to say, with respect to this campaign, I believe that you shouldn't take campaign donations from utilities, I don't, from red light camera operators, I don't, from big banks and insurance companies, I don't, and my opponent, Kwame Raoul, takes thousands of dollars from these entities like red light camera operators and utilities, and he's using that money to run me down with these commercials. We're going to win, I think, because I'm counting on everyday people to vote for me, not these insiders and big shots.
Governor, last question. If you do win the Democratic nomination, do you promise to come back and debate your Republican opponent here on Legal Faceoff?
Oh, absolutely. We've had several forums where all the candidates for Attorney General, the Republican candidates and the Democrats, all 10, come together. There's 8 candidates in the Democratic side. I'm Punch 8. I'm number one on the ballot there, so I hope to win. But I believe in robust debate, lots of opportunities for forums and debates, and I look forward to whoever wins the Republican side. I'll be there debating them, and that's the best thing for the voters, not for the insiders. I've always taken on the insiders, and it's time to do it again.
He is a Democratic candidate for Attorney General, and he is the former governor. Thank you so much for joining us, Pat.
Okay, thanks for calling, you guys. See you later.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit dlapiper.com.
And we move on to another candidate for Attorney General. It's sort of like a mini debate for Legal Face-Off, right? We're doing like a mini version of getting all the candidates for Attorney General. Thank you so much for joining us, Sharon Fairley.
Hey, how are you doing? I'm delighted to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Sharon. I'd like to kick off our discussion by asking you about the campaign financing aspect and the fundraising that was actually written about in the last couple of days about the eight candidates who are running on the Democratic side. You were actually quoted as stating that the Democratic contest has become the poster child for what's wrong with campaign finance laws in Illinois. Do you care to comment on that?
Yeah, so what I'm talking about here is that the system as it's currently set up right now, just money drives the process, and I don't think that what the result of that is. We're getting the best people for the jobs elected into office. What we're getting are the people who have the resources and connections to get the most money, and then go on air and run the most TV ads. And I don't think it's healthy in politics, and I don't think that's leading to the best representation for us as citizens. And so that's the problem that I have. And I think you see that in the way that this race has played itself out. You see a lot of donations, for example, flowing to one candidate from the established political establishment. A lot of elected officials. Senator Raul has received over a few hundred thousand dollars from elected officials, and these are individuals that could be the subject of investigations under his watch in the future, and I think that's just terribly problematic. His explanation for taking this money is, well, he needs the money to run a competitive race. And so I just think that the whole system is set up to create these conflicts, and it's just not a healthy way to get the best people elected to public office today.
Sharon, you're a former federal prosecutor, assistant attorney general. You served on the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, or COPA. How do you think these different experiences in your legal career prepare you to be the top law enforcement officer of the state of Illinois?
Well, these, professional experiences are terribly important, right? Because they have given me direct experiences directly relevant to the responsibilities of the Attorney General for the state of Illinois. So as a federal prosecutor, I prosecuted narcotics trafficking cases, so that gives me a perspective on the opioid crisis. I've prosecuted firearms trafficking cases, so that gives me a perspective on the gun violence problem here. I've prosecuted violent crimes cases, so I've worked side-by-side with law enforcement working to fight and prosecute violent crime. I've prosecuted complex fraud matters, which is directly relevant to the work of the consumer protection area of the office. And then, of course, as the chief administrator of the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, not only did I lead an agency that's responsible for complex legal matters, I actually built one from the ground up, creating the vision, designing the organization, that's, you know, best to fulfill the mission, and then going out and populating the agency by trying to hire the best and most qualified individuals to do the work that needed to be done. And so having had that experience, I will bring all that perspective to the Attorney General's office. So I, for example, will know, because I've led a large legal organization, I know how to, you know, drive efficiency and quality into the process. And I know how to create a vision that people get excited about working for. And it's having that kind of leadership ability that I've done that. And you can't say that there are other people in the race who have. And so that's why I think voters can really count on the fact that I will be able to do a good job in that role, because I have this really directly relevant experience.
So, Sharon, let's talk about the gun violence topic for a moment. Obviously, Parkland is still on everybody's mind. Gun violence continues to run rampant. What do you propose doing if you become the next Attorney General?
So when we think about Parkland, I mean, first of all, I'm so proud and delighted by the young people standing up, because they are actually responsible for some really good things happening right now. But it's a shame that it had to take that kind of violent incident for our political leaders to finally get themselves to gear to try to do the right thing here. So I'm tremendously optimistic and hopeful that we can get the Gun Dealer Licensing Act through, despite the fact that now Governor Rauner, unfortunately, is showing poor leadership and has decided that he's going to veto that measure. I'm really hoping that we can marshal the coalition to get that veto overridden. I'm very pleased that we got the bump stock ban through. That's a good first step. I would like to see a statewide assault ban put into place, and I'd also like to see the state preemption against gun regulation rolled back so that communities around our state can make their own decisions with regard to safety and gun control and gun safety measures. So that's what we need to do on the state level. I'm also very interested into talking about a red flag law here in Illinois, such that families or law enforcement can go before a court where there's an individual who has, there's evidence to demonstrate that individual is a threat to either themselves or someone else, that individual, if they're in possession of guns, those guns can be temporarily taken away. And we know that there are other states who have measures in place like this. And so I would like to see our legislature start to be serious about taking on something like that as well.
Sharon, I've been tasked with the lightning round of questions here. I'm going to ask you to give us some quick answers and let our listeners get really quick responses from you on a couple of key topics. Sexual assault, sexual harassment, statute of limitations, where do you stand on those? How long should they be?
So the sexual assault and sexual harassment issue that we're talking about here, you know, I've come out pretty strongly about, I believe that these things have been mishandled, and that we need to have more checks and balances in place so that people feel safe and that these things are investigated in an independent way. So, you know, one of the first things I pointed to is we need to change the statute governing the legislative inspector general, which is responsible for investigating those kinds of complaints.
Legalization of marijuana, where do you stand on that?
I'm definitely for legalization of marijuana, but I think we need to be thoughtful about how it's regulated to ensure public safety. So, for example, we need to make sure we understand how we're going to evaluate driving under the influence. We need to understand what, if any, limitations we're going to put on where it could be sold to keep children safe. So I think there's got to be some regulation around it, but other than that, I'm for it.
How about Chicago as a sanctuary city? We're covering this topic in terms of the federal attorney general's lawsuit in California against California as a sanctuary state. How would you as attorney general protect Chicago's status as a sanctuary city?
I'm definitely a proponent of sanctuary cities. I believe it's really important, not only just because it's the right thing to do morally and ethically, but it's also protecting immigrants. They're part of our communities. They participate and contribute to our communities, and it's a public safety issue. And so I, as Attorney General, I will use whatever powers I have available in the office, whether it's litigation, whether it's advocacy, to push back and protect sanctuary city status for any cities in Illinois, and also our position as a state in terms of enforcing the Trust Act.
And finally, the power tools. If elected, do you... Do you pledge to have a reunion with your band, the Power Tools, we learned about last night in the debate?
Well, I'll see if I can get them. I'll see if I can get them back together here. They're kind of spread out all over the world, actually, at this point. My former bandmates, but it was a fun part of my life. It's something that I loved. I loved singing, and it was a great time. So we'll see.
Last question. Do you promise to come back on Legal Faceoff to debate, if you win the nomination, to debate your Republican counterpart? Can we get a commitment from you right now?
I would be delighted to, because I really believe that that there are some – either candidate on the other side is not going to be in the best interest of the state of Illinois, in my view. So I'd be delighted to have the opportunity to have that debate.
She is a former federal prosecutor, assistant attorney general, and a criminal justice reform expert. Thank you so much for joining us, Sharon.
Thank you for having me. Take care, guys.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Faceoff. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Moving right along on Legal Faceoff, we introduce the professor at the University of San Francisco. He is the director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic and Dean's Circle Scholar, Professor Bill Hing. Welcome to Legal Faceoff.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today, Professor. Last week, as we all know, Attorney General Jeff Sessions filed a lawsuit against the state of California regarding its new slate of sanctuary state laws, claiming that it violated the Constitution. Obviously, the topic of sanctuary city and sanctuary states is a hotly debated topic in California and elsewhere. What can we expect with regard to this lawsuit, both procedurally as well as from a timeline perspective?
Well, this is a new suit that's been filed by the federal government in hopes of basically trying to make sure that California law enforcement agencies cooperate with federal ICE agents in their efforts to round up and deport people. So the main issue in the case is whether or not the states can essentially not cooperate in terms of immediately notifying ICE if they think they have somebody who might be deportable. And this is going to take time. This is just at the beginning stages of a federal lawsuit that's filed in a federal district court. And that can take at least a few weeks, if not a few months. Then there's going to be an appeal to the Court of Appeals. And then eventually one of the cases around the country dealing with sanctuary cities is going to reach the Supreme Court. But I doubt if that's going to happen sooner than 2 or 3 years from now.
What do you think the chances are of California successfully fighting this?
Well, I think that California has a very good chance. Here's the theory behind sanctuary ordinances advanced by the states. San Francisco, Santa Clara County, Los Angeles, they're not the only, and the state of California are not the only places. They're New Haven, Connecticut. There are places in Oregon and Washington that have similar ideas. The idea is that we need the cooperation of every part of the community when it comes to public safety. And if immigrant communities think that we are going to cooperate with ICE, they won't come to us if they're victims of crime or if they're witnesses of crime. So the idea that's being advanced by the state and by local jurisdictions is we're doing this for public safety. We're not doing this to interfere with immigration enforcement. And the legal issue, not to get too technical, but the legal issue is whether or not under the 10th Amendment, those kinds of states' rights are solid against the federal argument that they have the supremacy clause on their side, that they get to kind of come in when it comes to a federal issue. And the Supreme Court, this is going to be close at the Supreme Court, but I would say that the state has a good chance because they are asserting a pretty strong state's right, which is public safety.
Which is ironic, right, when you think about it, because most Republicans traditionally would argue in favor of states' rights, right? Most Republicans, if you're really, you know, on the conservative side of the Republican ledger, you would say that the federal government should step out of many things and leave it to the states. In this case, they're saying the opposite.
That's right. And ironically enough, one of the Supreme Court cases that the federal government is relying on is successful challenge that the Obama administration made against an Arizona law. Arizona passed anti-immigrant legislation several years back, SB 1070. And the conservatives were arguing, oh, well, Arizona should be able to pass its own immigration laws because they're concerned about their own well-being, and the government isn't doing, the federal government isn't doing their job. That's what Governor Jan Brewer argued. But the Supreme Court in that case actually struck down most of the Arizona law, saying that Arizona cannot create immigration laws. And so they argued, the Supreme Court agreed with the Obama administration that Arizona was actually trying to regulate immigration by making it illegal to be undocumented in Arizona, by mandating that Arizona law enforcement start rounding up undocumented immigrants, people who they thought were undocumented immigrants. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And so you cannot enforce immigration laws. So now Jeff Sessions is saying, well, look it, you struck down the Arizona law, you should strike down the California law. And the difference is going to be, is there a difference between a pro-immigration law versus an anti-immigration law? And as I said, the 10th Amendment cases basically, and preemption cases, basically are determined by whether or not the Supreme Court agrees with an asserted state interest. And that's what the issue is going to be. Does the Supreme Court buy it that California is saying, oh, public safety, we need immigrants to trust us? Or are they going to say, no, you are interfering and you're trying to regulate immigration by hiding undocumented immigrants? That's going to be the decision that the Supreme Court makes.
So do you want to comment a little bit? I mean, obviously, the Trump administration has a very strong interest in how this case turns out. Do you care to comment on that a little bit more about what the Trump administration has at stake? I mean, there's the obvious, but do you care to comment on that?
Yeah. So one thing that listeners should try to understand, that when it comes to interior enforcement, put aside the border for the moment, but when it comes to interior enforcement, even under the Obama administration, arrests interiorly are usually made through the cooperation of local law enforcement and ICE. And so outside of California, the vast majority of the country, police are cooperating with ICE. So what they have at stake is if the court does not strike down the sanctuary ordinances, then there could be other states that say, you know what, immigrants are part of our community and we want to protect them, so we also are going to pass a sanctuary ordinance. And so what's at stake here actually is the number of arrests that they can make in the interior. Because as much as the Trump administration gets a lot of publicity for random arrests here and there, you know, they'll show up and they arrest somebody and there's big headlines, they are not actually engaging in widespread raids of the nature quite frankly, that George W. Bush, his ICE, actually, there were some big raids where hundreds and thousands of people were arrested in the same day. So far, the Trump administration is basically going after people that didn't show up at hearings or who are abscondees, or they have a record of a criminal conviction for them. And while they are arresting those folks, then they ask other people in the building or at the workplace for their papers. And so that's a far cry from going into a factory and arresting 300 people. So I do think that they're planning those kinds of operations, but we actually haven't seen that yet.
The author of Ethical Borders, NAFTA, NAFTA's Globalization and Mexican Migration. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. We move on to something very exciting on Netflix with one of our favorite guests. Attorney Gloria Allred is here to talk about your new Netflix series. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah, the Netflix documentary is called Seeing Allred. Tell us, Gloria, how this all came to be. I know it took a while for the documentarians to convince you to be involved. Tell us a little bit about that history.
About 2 years, and then they, after they convinced me, and I agreed to it, then it took another 3 years of their following me. Of course, they understood that any communication I have with my clients is completely confidential, and they can't cover that, nor can they cover any legal strategy, but they felt there was enough public that I do that they could do the documentary, and they did, and we're just thrilled that the documentary Seeing Allred on Netflix now has received such terrific reviews, 100% positive reviews on Rotten Tomato. It made the grand jury U.S. Documentary competition out of 2,000 films submitted. Only 16 were accepted into the competition. We were one of them. So we were just thrilled with that result. But most of all, I'm thrilled that so many people have been emailing me from all over the world after they have seen the documentary and told me that they fired them up and they feel very empowered. And a lot of them are saying, I'm going to speak out against the boss who sexually harassed me. I'm going to talk to my husband and tell him he's going to have to treat me with respect. I'm going to go and fight for my rights and demand the respect and the dignity and the rights that I deserve to have. So I'm just thrilled that people are so excited about it. And you know, Doc, Netflix has more than 100 million subscribers worldwide. They've translated it into a number of different languages, so it's easily accessible. And I'm looking forward to everyone seeing it and letting me know what they think.
Yeah, it's an amazing film, and it talks about, you know, follows your evolution from an inner city school teacher in Philadelphia to, you know, the worldwide advocate for women's rights and you know, civil rights in general that you've become. And, you know, we're always very thankful that you appear on our show. Gloria, why did it take so long for this project to come about? I mean, I know.
Well, partly because, you know, I wanted to make sure that we're clear boundaries and, you know, in terms of my privacy. And also, again, that, you know, they needed to know what the boundaries would be for filming and in reference to my clients. I will say we agreed to this several months before the Bill Cosby story broke. We didn't even know that it was going to break. So they were able to cover quite a bit of that, a number of the accusers coming forward. And I was thrilled about that because many of the accusers wanted to be sure they had their voice heard, and now we know that the Bill Cosby trial is going to start actually in less than 2 weeks. And some of the accusers, there's an issue right now before the court about whether any other accuser of Bill Cosby will be permitted to testify at this upcoming second criminal trial of Mr. Cosby in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, or whether no accusers or just some will be permitted to testify. Of course, the prosecution wants 19 to be able to testify, and the defense wants no other accuser other than Audrey Constant, you know, the alleged victim in the criminal case, to be able to testify. So we're going to have to wait and see. This could not be more timely. But the most important part for me is I always have a goal of wanting to help to empower persons who allege they are victims to move from being victims to survivors to fighters for change. And you see that in the film. You actually see people being transformed before your very eyes. Women who allege they were victims of Mr. Cosby becoming survivors, becoming fighters for change, to change the law, to help others, even if it won't legally affect them. And how, you know, you just see that transformation, that how they fight through the tears and they are able to make a difference. So I'm just so proud that we're going to be able to see that in the film.
Gloria, the movie's done great, as you mentioned, through different platforms. It caused quite a splash at Sundance this year. What's it like? You know, you're no stranger certainly to being out in the media. You know, you're very well known for press conferences and your representation of your clients. But what's it like seeing yourself on the big screen? You know, you're not used to being in films, certainly. So how is it different being on a film on a big screen, being watched by, you know, hundreds of millions of people potentially versus, you know, folks watching your press conferences over the years?
Well, I mean, having been a teacher for 6.5 years, as you mentioned, in Philadelphia and then later in Watts, 1 year after the Watts riots or rebellion, depending on your point of view, that, you know, I see this as a teaching moment. I see that, you know, that we can view in this documentary the battle that we've had to wage for women's rights, the battle that other brave women whose names you have never heard have had to wage just to win their rights. And that no one, the teaching moment is that no one ever gives us our rights. We have to break through the silence and we have to become empowered in order to win our rights. And that is really what we see in the film, that battle. We can't take anything for granted. We haven't won all of our rights yet. We have a long, long way to go as women. And, you know, it just takes speaking out in the court of public opinion where it's appropriate to do so, and also takes asserting legal rights in court. It also takes, you know, going to the legislature to fight for new laws to protect our daughters and our granddaughters and our moms and our sisters and our aunts. And it just takes, you know, that kind of commitment. And so many people are making that now. I call this the year of empowerment of women. But actually, I hope it's going to be the age of empowerment of women, because only if women are empowered and specifically see what they can do, and everybody can do something, and usually a number of somethings. Only in that way are we going to win the rights that we deserve to have.
Gloria, about a minute left on Legal Face-Off. I'd be remiss if I didn't go from your movie and ask you very quickly about some issues in the news that I know you're very passionate about. For every step forward that the women's movement takes, as you just mentioned, it seems like, you know, as recently as this week, we've got President Trump calling Maxine Waters, you know, a very distinguished, long-serving member of the House, calling her a low IQ individual. We've got Stormy Daniels, who, you know, cannot tell her story of her relationship with Trump. Are you frustrated by, you know, even though there is some progress being made, that sometimes you're also taking two steps backwards in this movement?
Well, actually, Stormy Daniels did have her story published in Touch magazine not long ago. I think it was in the last couple of months. But having said that, she hasn't done any television that I know of, or, you know, interviews that way. My guess is she's got more to tell. And I also represent, by the way, Jessica Drake, who was listed as Angel Ryan, as a person in the settlement agreement that Stormy reached, as a person who she had told some confidential information to. In any event, look, this is, it's important, and the legal issues as to whether Stormy Daniels can do interviews are complex, whether this will be decided in arbitration or in a court of law or both. We'll have to see. But, I mean, I think the real focus really needs to be on President Trump, who should respond to the allegations that Ms. Daniels made but has not yet done so.
She is a civil rights advocate and author, the founding partner at her firm. Thank you so much for joining us, Gloria.
Thanks. I hope everybody sees Seeing All Red on Netflix. Thank you.
Now it's time for the legal grab bag, my favorite part of the show, which I love every part of your show, but this is the best part.
Who
of the
doesn't
show?
Love a legal grab
right?
bag?
It's
and
a free-for-all.
We start off with the Mueller investigation. Of course, Trump is apparently expanding
Trump
his legal
watch.
Team.
Trump Watch.
Yes.
We need sound effects for Trump Watch.
Dun, dun,
it's
dun.
It's time for Trump Watch.
Yes, well, finally, it looks like Trump is looking to expand his legal team. Word broke out at the end of last week that the White House has reached out to a senior partner at Williams & Connolly to potentially join the legal team assisting Trump with a special counsel probe into the 2016 election Russian interference. So Emmett Flood, who's with Williams & Connolly, apparently met with President Trump last week in the Oval Office to talk about potentially joining the Trump legal team. Flood, actually, if that name rings a bell, it's probably because he has extensive experience assisting presidents who happen to be under investigation, including working with President Clinton during his 1998 impeachment proceedings. In a tweet on Sunday, when asked about why he's looking to expand his legal team, President Trump insisted that he's very happy with his current team and that adding another lawyer is in no way symptomatic that he is doubting their capabilities. Flood was interviewed also over this past summer about joining the White House counsel's office to manage the special counsel probe. He was one of more than half a dozen attorneys who, after going through the interviewing process, decided to decline to assist the president. Since that time, the legal team has changed significantly, with Mark Kasowitz being replaced by John Dowd, who happens to have deeper Washington experience. What's interesting is that a number of legal commentators have suggested that Trump's team is too small given the circumstances and complexity of the Mueller investigation, and have speculated that it is important at this juncture for Trump to add additional resources to his team. It'll be interesting to see how much longer this investigation goes on. The fact that he's expanding the team at this time, it seems to indicate that this investigation may be going on for at least a little while longer. What do you think, Richard?
The House investigation is wrapping up. They released their report today, you know, heavily Republican-dominated report. No Democrats signed on to it. So that part is done, but that wasn't really the, you know, investigation that he's hiring lawyers for. It's, of course, the special counsel Mueller's investigation. Yeah, this is a high-powered Washington firm. They've represented, in addition to Bush, you mentioned, Cheney, Oliver North, lots of heavy hitters over the years. I can only imagine the money being spent on counsel in this case by Trump.
The only competition, I think, is the amount of money being spent trying to have the Secret Service follow Donald Trump everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, lawyers are doing pretty well by this Mueller investigation.
Yeah, no, I wonder if they're all getting paid from the campaign fund, too, right? The NRA is suing Florida? This is sort of, that's a surprising thing.
Say it's sort of disgusting?
Yeah,
sort of.
I was trying to be a little more PC, but yeah, it's awful.
Yeah, I mean, in the wake of Parkland, the Florida legislature put together a bill that, among other things, would deal with raising the minimum age to purchase a gun to 21. Of course, that is opposed by the National Rifle Association. They have now filed a lawsuit very quickly. They filed a lawsuit alleging that this law in Florida violates the Second Amendment rights of 18-year-olds. I mean, I say that almost laughing because it's almost a joke that they would file this lawsuit, but very predictable. NRA believes that the Second Amendment protects the rights of everyone to buy guns at the age of 18. They have argued that if you're able to go out and fight a war and use these guns in a war situation, then you should be able to use them at home. Certainly opposed by the Republican governor of Florida, Rick Scott, who has signed it into law, signed it last Friday very quickly. It also includes $67 million for sheriffs to train personnel at school, bans the sale of bump stocks. The question is, bigger picture, how this is going to be dealt with at the federal level. Trump, as recently as yesterday in Sarah Sanders' press conference, in her daily press briefing, said that, you know, the president is now going to focus on things like bump stocks that he can have some influence over. It seems like she has signaled an abandonment of lowering or raising the age to buy these kind of guns. So they're certainly wavering. Lots of people predicted that, even though he had that, you know, meeting where he was admonishing members of the legislature, that they would be scared of the NRA. That's why they didn't add the age limit. He said, oh, that's because you're petrified of the NRA. Seems like Trump is now also scared of the NRA after his his recent meetings with them.
Legal Face Off's favorite porn star is in the news. Stormy Daniels, of course.
I didn't know we had a favorite porn star.
That has to be our
favorite porn star.
I don't know. I don't know about that,
okay.
Craig.
All right.
I don't object to having a favorite porn star. I object to you naming
this
her.
This particular person being a favorite porn star.
I didn't check with either of you either. I just sort of assumed.
I've got a long
library. Well, my favorite porn star, Stormy Daniels, is still in the news. What's going on now?
Well, Stormy has now, her attorney has offered to give back the money that she received. It was $120,000, I believe, in exchange for the confidentiality agreement resulting from the settlement of her lawsuit involving Trump. Of course, Stormy Daniels is the alleged, how do we call it, girlfriend, paramour, gal pal.
Porn star interest?
Yes, right. of Trump, and of course, signed a confidentiality agreement that many in the media are trying to encourage her to walk away from. Of course, she has a legal duty to follow it if she signed it. There's, of course, much discussion about whether it's enforceable because, you know, it wasn't paid by Trump. It wasn't signed by Trump. It was paid by his attorney. So lots of calls to get additional information from her. There's a 60 Minutes piece that is waiting to be released in which she does apparently talk more about it. But at the end of the day, it really depends on whether or not she is going to return this money. And Trump has the right to, you know, accept it or not accept it according to the terms of their contract.
So where do you think this is going, Rich?
I think we'll hear from her. I mean, I think there's no, you know, denying the fact that we will hear from her. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think big picture, you know, so what? It's going to have no effect on Trump. I think Trump would and has acknowledged that. I mean, he has bragged about, you know, his relationships over the years. I think that most people understand that, yes, he had an affair with Stormy Daniels. Yes, it was while he was married. So what? Right. I mean, if the Access Hollywood tape in which we heard him, right?
The infamous tape Billy Bush.
Right. If that didn't detract or you know, make his presidency or candidacy at that time self-destruct, then this is not going to have any effect. I mean, he had this rally the other day where he was just, you know, throwing red meat to his base, talking about, you know, a congresswoman who has a low IQ, talking again about Elizabeth Warren, calling her Pocahontas. He called out Chuck Todd as being sleepy-eyed. He said he's a son of a bitch. You know, there's nothing, I think, that you can say about this man to his base that would change their opinion of him. So I don't think, even if she talks and says, yeah, I had an affair, big deal, to his base.
Well, I think there's going to be more tawdry details than that.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm excited. There's text messages, Rich. I want to see what a Trump texts to Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
We move on to something in local news. DePaul University is being sued by one of their law professors.
Yes. DePaul law professor Terry Smith filed a lawsuit against the school last Wednesday in federal court, claiming that the school retaliated against him because of his advocacy for racial diversity at the school. The lawsuit seems to be precipitated by the fact that Professor Smith supported one of his fellow professors, Donald Herman, who was the subject of student complaints for using the N-word in a criminal law hypothetical about a white supremacist. Smith took the position that use of this word was not gratuitous in the context of talking about this hypothetical, and that, in fact, this particular colleague of his, Professor Herman, is probably the most progressive of his white counterparts at the school. He also claims that had Herman used a different word to describe the slur in the hypothetical, it would water down the significance of the discussion about the topic. Smith's lawsuit states that for the better part of a decade, he has been in an environment at the school that is hostile. He claims that this has caused other faculty to retaliate by freezing him out of the law school's leadership framework. He claims that the law school's dean recommended that he be fired because he opposed the tenure applications for two law professors. Mm-hmm. And these professors claim that Smith opposed their tenure because they did not agree with his views that there is racism at the school. Smith said that his opposition was actually motivated by the fact that he doubted their qualifications and had nothing to do with racial issues. Professor Smith is actually being accused of engaging in bullying that rises to the level of extreme intimidation and aggression and led to the dean's recommendation that he be fired. But apparently there doesn't seem to be any substantiation for these claims in his personnel file. The law school dean also claimed that the disciplinary process against Professor Smith began in response to a number of longstanding complaints from his colleagues.
I don't know where this lands in the tier list of things you shouldn't mess up, but embryos seem fairly important, and apparently a Ohio hospital damaged some.
Yeah, too. There's now a case in California as well, San Francisco, another embryo clinic. Messed up the equipment, messed up the storage tank, malfunctioned, and lost as many as 2,000 frozen eggs and embryos. Understandably, the potential parents whose embryos were lost are now filing suit. There's actually a class action that was filed Sunday, or the suit is seeking class action status, more accurately. It was filed Sunday, seeking damages for, you know, these embryos that are no longer viable. This industry is not regulated by the federal government. They're actually self-regulated, I've learned. And these things happen, not very frequently, thankfully, but sometimes the equipment does fail. And understandably, these people who put their, you know, trust and belief in this equipment are very unhappy and therefore are filing, you know, a lawsuit. And there's obviously lots of victims of it. I mean, there's, you know, in one case, like I said, as many as 2,000 frozen eggs. So
perhaps it should be regulated.
Seems like it might be a good idea.
Have a backup system, you know, because unfortunately there are a lot of people who are very upset right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question.
We move from some sad topics to, I think, one of the best ones. The Utah Bar has apparently figured out how to do email blasts. This is, they've cracked the code. They sent a topless photo, which they're obviously horrified about. But hey, I bet you a lot of people paid attention to this email.
Yes. Have you seen the photo?
I haven't. I got to find it.
Oh, yes.
I'm on my work computer.
Yeah, not on your work computer. All right. No one open this on your work computer because otherwise your IT folks are going to come after you.
Right.
So the Utah State Bar claims it is horrified after sending out an email blast a week ago that included a photo of a topless woman. Apparently, the message was sent to all active Utah lawyers and was for the purpose of promoting the bar's spring convention. In addition to including the photo of the topless woman, there are also photos of the clothed Lady Justice statue and a rock formation. Let's talk about a hodgepodge of photos. 20 minutes after the email went out, the Utah Bar's IT director sent a follow-up email stating that they deeply apologize for having sent the offensive email and were currently investigating the cause. The bar thinks that it was either their email getting hacked or an employee who either accidentally or intentionally added the topless photo to the email. The Utah Bar subsequently issued a statement blaming human error for the inclusion of the photo in the email. Wow.
I'm just looking for the photo. Have you seen it?
Oh, I've seen it.
I clicked on it. I couldn't help myself. I've seen it now at work, too. And I bet you a lot of people paid attention to this email. They're going to have more people sign up.
One lawyer said he wants $100 deducted from his next bar dues to compensate him for my loss of innocence. Because remember, we're talking about Utah here, a very, very conservative state.
And no offense to both of you, we are talking about lawyers here. I don't know how much innocence was lost.
I'm not sure that there was any innocence lost.
Yeah.
Someone's trying to make a buck.
Steve Harvey is in the news with a new $5 million lawsuit.
Yeah, this was just after he had another lawsuit that was dismissed. So he had he was faced with a $60 million lawsuit by his ex-wife, who claimed that after their divorce, which happened in 2005, the lawsuit said that he damaged her soul. She alleged child endangerment, conspiracy against rights, torture, breach of contract, intentional infliction of emotional distress. Harvey denied all of the accusations. And the case was actually dismissed recently because the judge felt that it belonged in Texas, where they got divorced. Steve Harvey is no stranger to lawsuits. He was previously faced with a lawsuit from a former employee who said that he was hired to raise $20 million for Steve Harvey's organization, was promised a 12.5% cut. When the money came in, he never got his cut. But this latest lawsuit, that's a big preamble to
it is
the
a big
latest
preamble.
Steve
But
Harvey.
You know what? You're famous for your preambles.
I am. Rambling and off topic. But Steve Harvey is now facing a $5 million lawsuit for stalking, harassment, civil rights violations, witness tampering, and intimidation. This is from S.C. Berry, who
Guess
used to represent
is.
His ex-wife, right?
Yeah.
Not his ex-wife.
His ex-wife, but you know, do you know who she
but wait,
is?
Wait, I thought this was, this says a woman who used to represent his ex-wife. So anyway, yeah, S.C. Berry happens to be the widow of Rerun. Hey, hey, hey.
Hey. What's happening?
What's happening? My favorite star of 70s TV, What's Happening? Rerun Barry, this is his ex-wife, who says that Harvey had it out to get her ever since his ex-wife, Mary Vaughn, was asked to be part of a reality show. The reality show's name was Widows, Wives, and Ex-Celebrity Wives. So I think she might be the rep of his ex-wife, not his actual ex-wife, but
of Barry's
knows?
Widow.
It's very, very confusing how many ex-wives are involved here.
And widows.
Widows.
Don't forget about the widows.
Is Rerun a consensus pick for our favorite 70s TV show?
Okay, well, only to be contended with maybe Different Strokes.
Good Times.
Or
good
anyone on MASH.
Yeah, Good Times.
I mean, they
well, MASH, good. I mean, now almost, I think, is Alan Alda the only one left from MASH?
Yeah. No. Well, David Ogden Stiers just died.
Yes.
But Mike Farrell.
That's true.
I just saw him in the Versace movie, the one from Ryan Murphy. He plays Lee Miglin.
Mm-hmm.
Who was killed, wife of Marilyn Miglin, killed in Chicago.
Oh.
But, wow, way off topic. Let's get back to Steve
hey,
Harvey. Family
this
Feud,
the guy
star
who,
of the
oh,
Family
yes.
Feud.
Yeah.
Okay,
my
Richard
favorite,
Dawson will always be my favorite.
Your
I'm
favorite
sorry.
Family Feud host?
Wasn't Drew Carey Family Feud host,
no,
too?
No, he's
or
Price
is he
right.
Price is Right.
How many other Family Feud hosts can you name? Richard Dawson, you said?
Oh,
Steve
there
Harvey.
Was that guy who committed suicide.
Yeah, Richard.
What was his name?
He committed suicide by banging his head against the wall.
Oh.
Not the greatest way to go.
No.
There was Richard Karn, or the guy from...
Karn. Yes,
home,
from Home Improvement.
That guy?
Yes.
And then Louis Anderson.
Oh, that's right.
I love Family Feud, though. It's on constant rotation in my home. My kids love it. We do a lot of the home game.
But the original
Should we do
one
a little LFO Family Feud?
Yeah, I think we could.
100 listeners surveyed.
top answers are on the board.
Yeah, top five answers on the board. Name Tina Martini's favorite guest on Legal Face Off.
Ding, 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 ding,
ding. That would be David Sessler.
Surprising.
What if I said somebody else?
Yeah.
Do you do divorces, Rich?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. So thank you so much. This is Legal Face Off signing off. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. We'll be back in a couple weeks.
Cue the Family Feud theme.